All right, guys, welcome to the June 18th edition of Cascadian Views. We're back with our full crew this week. JJ has returned, and Dan is once again here with me. How are you guys?
Hello, hello. Doing well?
Doing okay.
So we, I guess we can't escape from the fact that the top half of the show is going to be about the Trump investigation. It seems like that is roughly every single week type thing to do. But it does appear to have taken a significant new development. Comey had indeed told Trump that he was not under investigation 3 times. That changed, I guess, with the Comey firing is what pushed Mueller to take that on. This has fueled Trump's anger. He calls this a witch hunt. He even appeared to confirm in a tweet that he was under investigation, saying that he's under investigation by the man who told him to fire the FBI director for firing the FBI director. His lawyer has cast some doubt on that today on the Sunday shows, saying that the president's not under investigation, while at the same time acknowledging that the president is under investigation. It doesn't seem like he knows what to say. It provoked a rather testy response with Chris Wallace over on the Fox News channel. Pointed out the complete hypocrisy, not just in Trump's tweets, which the other morning show host had done, but with the lawyer's statements as well. It's a clusterfuck, at least to me, it seems like. The Trump team is trying to deny reality as if that's a viable strategy.
And it's worked for them so far.
It's hard for them to do it, though, when the president himself is going out and confirming, or at least inadvertently, the reports coming up in the Washington Post. Yeah.
So this had to be a step that we anticipated, correct? That this would move into this?
Into obstruction of justice? Yeah, absolutely. I think... especially, you know, after Comey's testimony, it was hard to believe it couldn't be headed that way. Although, of course, according to the Post, it looks like it's been building, or at least they started looking into that basically as soon as Comey was fired, before Mueller was even appointed as, you know, special counsel. So, yeah, I think what we have is it looks like in any context except dealing with the president of the United States, you'd be looking at an obstruction of justice. The only question is really how much effort Congress is going to be willing to make to follow through on what the evidence is going to show. Like what the president has basically admitted to.
Multiple times.
Yeah.
The seemingly low-hanging fruit being investigated early, I would say, in this one. We saw it with the look into Kushner, who has admitted to crimes at this point. He admitted he lied on his security clearance and has made efforts to correct the record on that. In this case, the obstruction charge, what's the use of the obstruction charge? If it were against somebody lower on the totem pole, I'd say it's what you roll them up with. It's what you use to secure their cooperation, the fact that you won't pursue the obstruction charge. The fact that they're investigating this early in the Trump probe is a little bit, I guess, strange to me.
Well, it is something that's fairly obvious, and they can build the case on that fairly quickly. What is going to take a lot more time, and I think they're also going to be working on that track. We're seeing more and more that Mueller is building a team that's going to be built to investigate a lot of the financial aspects of the greater scandal slash potential crimes. Trump's extensive dealings with post-Soviet oligarchs going back to the 1990s, when he couldn't get legitimate financing anymore, and he's continued this pattern probably after the point, it looks like, when it was no longer legal to do so, when it became, when it went from shady business practices to effectively money laundering after the sanctions went into effect after the invasion of Ukraine. So, I mean, there's going to be a lot to look into. I think the obstruction of justice charges, that's what I think they can't not look at it now just because there's been so much evidence laid out for it. The president's admitted it. They have to at least, you know, document that this is something that's happened, and they, whatever else they turn up, this is a crime that they could bring to Congress and say this needs to be charged.
Yeah, like I almost see it as like a charge to just kind of pin on the board to keep some pressure off the FBI and Mueller to be like, look, y'all know that this is a thing and this is the low hanging fruit and we all know that this is there. But this is just part of the cover up of the actual investigation that we're supposed to be doing. So yeah, I feel like it's being used so early as it is, like, to shield the remaining parts of the investigation so that they can actually start digging up the stuff that Dan's talking about.
Speaking of which, JJ, I think you're really onto something there. I mean, there's been a lot of talk from the White House this week that, you know, or at least from Trump himself, from people who are close to him, that he may fire Mueller. Exactly. And he could probably find someone in the Justice Department to do it. He'd likely have to fire Rosenstein first, but it is something he might do. And so I think there's more than a fair amount of speculation, and I think it's probably grounded that the fact that Trump himself is under investigation for something that everyone, I think, should know that he would have been under investigation for is one more way to keep, put firing Mueller off limits.
One more shield for that particular part of this battleground.
Exactly.
Because, you know, as the, you know, the reports we've no doubt been reading, like, staffers begging him not to fire Mueller. I mean, like, people, like, anything, you know, distract him with a stuffed animal if you have to, or just, like, keep him in the pout room on timeout so that he cannot fire Robert Mueller. Like, good God. Like, yeah, so he's trying hard, but everybody knows how that's kind of play out, and it will not be well for anybody close to the administration.
Right. I mean, it becomes an admission of guilt if he goes out and does it. You know, one more admission of guilt. And I mean, I think it's something that, dealing again with a conventional president, it's a strong defensive maneuver. Would probably be foolproof against a conventional president. With Trump, and there's always the possibility that he's going to be so impulsive and self-destructive that he'll do it anyway if they can't keep distracting him and keeping his mind on something else. But if he does, then it's just so far out of bounds that it makes the question that ends up going before congressional Republicans at that time all the more stark. You know, are they going to tolerate this level of lawlessness?
I have a question about this investigation for you, Dan. Probably understands a bit more from a legal perspective. Trump's crisis lawyer that he brought in has recommended against White House staff fielding their own attorney. He wants to collect it all in one room. I guess that allows him to protect the president better, probably at the expense of people who don't have lawyers. But with that information this week, in fact, just in the last few days, Vice President Mike Pence and Trump's own White House counsel, Michael Cohen, have both secured outside legal defense, their own personal lawyers. Is that sort of mixed signal going to cause any problems? From the side of it?
I don't know if it causes problems for Trump himself, but I think Cassowitz, Trump's lawyer, is, I think he's probably, you know, I'd have to look at the specific rules of, you know, the New York and the Washington state bars, but that seems to be very close to improper advice to be giving to non-clients. you know, because he doesn't represent these people. You know, that's the sort of thing that, you know, the White House counsel wouldn't even say to, you know, White House staff. You know, they'd make it clear that, you know, hey, we are not your attorney. You know, we represent the White House. So, you know, if you're going to get your own counsel, that's your own business. But, you know, we're not here to look out for your interests. And Cassowitz, who is Trump's personal lawyer, absolutely is not there and is not hired to look for their interests. I think, you know, it, you know, like I said, I'd need to look at some of the specific rules of the New York bar, but he may have put himself in some of his own ethical jeopardy by giving that advice to White House staff. And I think Pence, I think Cohen are absolutely being smart by retaining their own attorneys in this situation. You know, I don't think Cassowitz or Trump would hesitate to throw them over the boat if it came down to it.
And that's kind of what I've been reading too, is that, like, he might not be in a position to do it. It's definitely not in Stafford's interests.
Right.
And then, you know, flip side, it could also be a remaining loyalty test for a lot of White House staffers. Like,
oh my God.
Right? No, I mean, think about it that way. Like, we're still dealing with, like, a supervillain, like a narcissistic supervillain. So all of this is also a loyalty test. Like, will you eat the bowl of shit for me and then go to jail because I'm an idiot? And if you're willing to fall on that sword, cool, then you're loyal. I mean, you get prison, so it's not like it's a great gig, but he's not a great supervillain. But,
you know, George W. Bush, they pardoned the people that fell on swords for them. You know, Nixon didn't have the chance to, but George W. Bush, they both issued pardons to the staff that went into the shady stuff for him. I don't think Trump is going to have that kind of loyalty for these people.
Yeah, I think at best, like, Trump would hold a press conference to congratulate himself for hiring these people in the first place. And then, like, just ignoring that they're in jail.
Yeah. It's totally unfair what's happening to them. Nope, not going to pardon them, but, you know, it's totally unfair.
Yeah. Total bummer. Oh, pardon them? Nah, that probably wouldn't be right, but, you know.
Liberals like Robert Mueller throwing these people in jail for things they did on my behalf.
The larger narrative under the Mueller, about the Mueller investigation from the right, Dan, you kind of alluded to this about him building a team. There's been a lot of pushback, namely over the fact that some of the people he hired have, you know, committed the unsanctionable sin of donating to Democrats in the past. Have we really reached the point in society where the party will only accept an investigation from its own rank and file?
I don't know about the party as a whole, but certainly the Trump administration itself. You know, if they're questioning Mueller at this point, I think it's pretty clear that there's no investigator, there's no authority that they would consider legitimate to actually look into their business if they can't accept Mueller. You know, everyone else in Washington has basically been come out and said, this is the best person you could possibly get for this case. This is a longtime Republican, absolutely unquestioned integrity. Both parties have asked to keep him on board in the government for decades. There's nobody better for this job. And the people he trusts are very much in the same vein. But yeah, I think that it's part of the ongoing destruction of the rule of law that Trump is willing and his allies are willing to bring that kind of character destruction to Mueller and his team and say, look, if you weren't wearing a MAGA hat, then you can't be investigating the president. You can't be trusted to be impartial if you weren't at the rallies.
I mean, because I was going to say, more than just that they donated to Democrats, which, you know, is the easy one for them, I think the tactic would have been the same had these people donated to Republicans who did not support Donald Trump.
Right.
And I mean, to be honest, the list of high-powered Republican lawyers and, you know, police officials in Washington that did support Trump that probably already work for him.
Right. Or they've been burned already at this point.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, the rest of the professional party, I think we talked a little bit about this last week, but you know, Trump's been trying to hire them and they've been telling him to take a walk.
He finally got a DC lawyer to join his team. We talked about that briefly last week and they basically told him to fuck off. He got the gentleman who defended John McCain back in the Keating 5 scandal.
Yeah. Who was that? I mean,
I can look that up real quick. The Keating 5 scandal, if I recall correctly, that was about the savings and loan crisis, right?
Yeah. I mean, the other high profile hire I heard Trump make was Sokolow, but again, he's not one of the. He's not someone you'd expect to go to for an investigation like this. He's usually doing, I think he's. Hallmark is free speech law and
as the probe
First Amendment cases on behalf of conservative Christians. So
it was John Dowd.
Okay.
As I mentioned, he defended or represented John McCain during the ethics investigation of the Keating 5 scandal. John McCain was the only one of those senators cleared, by the way. He also investigated Pete Rose from Major League Baseball, so, you know, stand-up man, integrity all around.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to make light of Pete Rose's issues. They were serious. I have no problem Major League Baseball bringing down the banhammer with that, but they went out of their way to harass and hound that man for decades and decades.
Yeah.
So I don't look at that investigation in entirely positive light, despite the fact that Pete Rose is no angel.
Yeah, okay, I'm looking at some of his other cases, and yeah, he's definitely more the type of attorney that you would actually want to hire for a case like this. Some of the previous clients that jump out at me are Monica Goodling. It's a little more ancient history, but not quite so ancient. She was heavily involved in the Bush Department purge of U.S. attorneys in 2006. And was in some pretty significant legal jeopardy. Dowd advised her to take the Fifth, and she was able to avoid the worst of that.
So, just as a little anecdote to close off our talk and investigation a little bit, I was very amused to find that the AP has numerous sources, I believe five. Five different sources who will confirm to them that President Trump has been yelling at his TVs in the morning. Not only that, but he's been TiVoing the morning shows to watch them later at night, because those are the only shows he likes, are the morning cable news shows.
No wonder he's going nuts. he's going to pull an Elvis or something on it. You know, he's just going to shoot the TV out. And that's fine.
He and John McCain and Lindsey Graham just need to wander around the Rose Garden with onions tied in their belts.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So we'll move on from the investigation, but I think we'll stick on Trump for just a moment here. He has a very strained relation with the Prime Minister of Australia, Malcolm Turnbull. This is a little bit confusing to me because Nicholas Turnbull, wait, is it Malcolm or is it Nicholas? Malcolm Turnbull. Malcolm Turnbull has a well-known history of hating brown people. So, you know, you would think that Trump and him would be right at his brain. But there was a very testy phone call early in the Trump administration, and now leaked audio footage, has Turnbull mocking Trump at a comedian's dinner. It seems to be a dinner, and forgive me, I'm not super familiar on Australian political media, but it seems to be something akin to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where the Prime Minister meets with a lighthearted flair with some of the country's notable media elite. By convention, it's not open to the public. The videos are not released. It's a private affair. The political editor for a major TV network in Australia received video and decided to break the taboo and publish it because of its newsworthiness. This can't end well for these two, at least any hope of friendship that they might have, I would imagine. Trump is the type of man that takes personal slights to a very childish level.
Mm-hmm. He's running out of world leaders that aren't insulting him either very closely to his back or to his face. Unfortunately. Yeah,
the Saudi royal family and Duterte of the Philippines, I believe, are probably the only world leaders not mocking him.
Right.
I mean, even Kim Jong-un came out against Trump for pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Like, I mean, damn, like everybody.
That's a nice little segue to something I wanted to talk about this week, and that is North Korea itself. There's been a ratcheting up of tensions lately. Dennis Rodman was deployed to North Korea for the second time because he was in the world where that happened.
Didn't he just deploy himself this time? I think he just likes it.
Yeah, no, I don't think he was sent there on behalf of the government.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Or Vice News, as was his previous two times.
I did point out last year, Dennis Rodman did endorse Trump. So it's entirely possible this is official.
I just, for a transvestite minority, how do you endorse Trump? How does that work?
He's a weird guy.
I guess, actually, Trump apparently liked him during Celebrity Apprentice a couple years back. Still fired him, but reportedly
right.
liked him. So maybe if you're one of the good ones, Trump won't hate you.
I think that's got to be the connection. That's,
or know, just the, like, don't give a shit attitude. Maybe yeah. that plays well with him. That would make sense with, like, Steve Bannon and whatnot. And some of the people Trump surrounds himself with. Maybe it's just the, like, there's a certain degree of nihilism that you have to engage in to be proximate to that man.
A complete disregard for social norms is something that they see as a kindred spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Only, you know, it should be the good ones and not the no-Nazis kind of ones.
Yeah. I mean, decidedly, they've largely chosen from the wrong list, but...
well, Dennis Rodman, within approximately 2 hours of his landing in the country, North Korea had released an American citizen that they had been holding for, I believe it was a year and a half, perhaps closer to 2 years. The young man that they released, a University of Virginia student, had been in a coma for some time, according to North Koreans, since his trial, where they say he was infected with botulism and took a sleeping pill, the combinations which led to the coma. American doctors who examined the man have found no traces of botulism whatsoever in his body. The North Koreans did not let anybody in America know about the man's condition until they were physically handing him over. There's extensive brain damage, loss of brain tissue at this point. This man will likely never wake up. I think of the reading between the lines on the reports. He's lost a substantial amount of his brain, just the atrophies of being in a year and a half long coma. At this point, the U.S. appears to have retaliated in some way. North Korean diplomats on their way to the U.N. mission, or from the U.N. mission at JFK Airport, were detained by U.S. authorities who seized a diplomatic satchel. Diplomatic satchels are incredibly important in international diplomacy. They are exempt from customs. They're small pouches that countries can use to communicate with their own diplomatic services. They contain private secret documents. Usually, North Koreans have in the past use them for smuggling. They run extensive drug production operations, mostly centered around methamphetamine, which is something of a national delicacy in North Korea. They also operate a number of restaurants, which is their less nefarious way of raising hard currency. These are mostly in China, although occasionally in other parts of Asia as well. They feature entirely North Korean staff and are notable for occasionally defecting en masse. There have been numerous times in the last 10 years that the entire staff of one of these restaurants have picked up and applied for asylum together. It does not surprise me that we did this. It happened so quickly, I'm really not sure if we did our due diligence. I'm a little bit scared. We just decided to pluck one of these from these guys just to say we could, and we're not actually positive. So it seemed to have happened very, very bad.
I'm still stuck on the restaurant thing. I'm sorry. Those Pollos Hermanos DPKR edition, like meth dealing restaurateurs. Like, I've watched this show, man.
couple of times now, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, the grab bag, I'm like, I don't even know how to feel about this, to be honest. Like, I kind of instinctually want to agree with you, Brock. Like, well, this is a thing we're really not supposed to do. You know, when everything's above board, these are the things you don't do. And so that pretty much makes it douchey and pretty shitty. But then again, like, it's crazy North Korea and they're doing some crazy shit. So maybe we should steal their weird meth bag. I don't know.
I want to know what was in it. Were there legitimate diplomatic papers in there, or was it like bundles of unmarked $100 bills? And also, if there were bundles of unmarked $100 bills, let's not forget North Korea is cut off from the international banking system. They use bundles of cash. They have a Yongyang, is the name of the restaurant chain, that's over 130 of them in a couple dozen countries around the world. They do these to raise money. They also do more illicit things, methamphetamine smuggling, occasionally prostitution running in China, until the Chinese government gets kind of pissed off at them and cracks down on it for a couple of years. There are legitimate sources of money, there are illegitimate sources of money, and there are actual diplomatic paperwork. I don't trust this administration I don't have anything wrong with tit for tat. They put this young man to the coma. If we want to crack down on one of their drug rings, $100,000, totally fine by me. That's actually what this was. There was a warrant for that bag, if all the legalities were followed, if it contained what we thought it contained. This happened in about 48 hours. I don't know if I trust this administration to know what they're doing in 48 hours. It is entirely possible that they decided to pick on some random North Korean diplomat and run him for a bag, which contains...
And just figured it was, I mean, that it had to contain something of interest, you know, one way or the other. They're like, well, you know, maybe we get lucky and it's like blackmail material for a bunch of UN diplomats.
Yeah. Anyway, this follows increasing provocation on both sides of this issue. When South Korea and China are on the same side and telling everybody to calm the fuck down, maybe we need to calm them down. Maybe North Korea needs to calm the fuck down. I'm pretty sure China and South Korea have an accurate take on the situation. Neither side seems like they're calming the fuck down.
Sure. Well, it's been a weird approach that we've been taking, at least for the last 6 months, to the whole region. I mean, we've had Trump making various statements and especially hostile gestures at North Korea. It sounds like they've been in talks with the Chinese government, basically offering to pay them to put more pressure on North Korea, which I think most people would agree is...
Pay us. I remember this being a major Trump campaign point.
Exactly. Well, and also, getting North Korea to behave responsibly is also something that is in China's interest. So it's not something we should be paying them to do. So, yeah, it also sets a bad precedent on that front as well. So much for making great deals on our behalf.
All right. Let's flip it around. We have two more national stories before we switch over to the local stuff. JJ, the next two you submitted. One, I've actually been following along, although I didn't think to put a link in here. And that is, there are now criminal charges against five officials in Michigan over the Flint water crisis, including involuntary manslaughter charges for Michigan's top health officer.
Yeah, it's, yeah, both of these stories are rather remarkable legal stories. Like, I was going to say victories, but nothing's really happened just yet. But at the same time, this, even having somebody charged for this kind of feels like a victory, because this never happens. So very, I mean, I guess it'll happen more in this situation because they're actually individuals, they're in government, as opposed to, you know, corporations and corporate boards and CEOs who never face criminal charges for acts of pollution and whatnot. But this is indeed a spot of good news and a push in the right direction, that people who made absolutely, I mean, terrible and indeed criminal decisions in Flint, Michigan, in the water crisis that for the large part, I believe, still continues, that they might actually be brought, yeah, really face and be convicted for manslaughter. And yeah, as you said, it's five folks. What is it? Stephen Bush, a water supervisor for the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. Darnell Early, state-appointed emergency manager for Flint. Howard Croft, the former director of the Public Works Department. And Leanne Skelter-Smith, who was the chief of the state's Office of Drinking Water. On top, yeah.
Don't actually stem from the lead problem at all. They stem from,
right,
the Legionnaires outbreak, which actually was the source of the discovery of the lead outbreak. In 2015, there was a massive spike in Legionnaires disease, which typically occurs in like water tanks at the top of hotels and whatnot. It's named after a foreign legion. Outposts that are whatever they are, that was the first case described. The investigation into the Legionnaires outbreak was hampered for a long time by state health officials who feared what it would show, which is exactly what was later discovered, the change in water providers to the local but heavily polluted Flint River, which was much more corrosive than the previous water sources used, was eroding away the pipes, which allowed the Legionnaires to get in, which is also how the lead issue developed.
Yeah, it's an interesting part about all this story that, you know, people are being charged for, I mean, and I don't want to undercut the severity of the issue, but like a small piece of what in the public imaginary is the Flint water crisis. We talk much less, I feel, about the Legionnaires' disease than we do about the lead water quality issues.
I think on a big part of that is that the lead is a slower paced but more chronic problem. Whereas if
you
have Legionnaires, you know you have Legionnaires, and
it'll
pass if it doesn't kill you. In the case of 185,
yeah, it only killed, I believe, the one from what I was reading, or maybe a couple more.
Whereas
they cited the death of one person in the case. They didn't cite other deaths in the claim.
All right. The Attorney General, I believe, is a Democrat in Michigan. Is that correct? I do know that they have divided government. Their governor is a Republican. Oh, no,
he's a Republican Attorney General as well. Yeah.
This is a. I know the governor.
And a man with soulless eyes.
Yeah. We all Googled him at the same time, huh?
Yeah. God, look.
The governor has announced that he will not be removing these officials from their post during the trial, which, you in a modern American state, you have to at least put them on a leave of absence. They're being accused of killing people with their jobs. Let them fight the charges if they're innocent, bring them back. But serious accusations have been raised. You have to at least put these people on administrative leave until the trial's in.
State of Michigan says finish the job.
Jeez.
It's pretty cold over there in Michigan. Pretty cold.
Ridiculous. All right. Well, we're gonna move on to our last bit of national news here, and this is a long-awaited check-in with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and the saga of the water protectors trying to protect the Sioux source of drinking water from the Dakota Access Pipeline. We last checked on the story with the Sioux saying that they were grateful for all the help of the water protectors, but that they wanted everybody to go home, and that the phase of the fight has moved into courts. JJ, we now have a bit of news about how the courts are going. You want to fill us in?
Yeah, it's been a long time since we checked in on this, and since then the pipeline has been completed. And then this story addresses whether or not they shut it off. So it's, the decision is kind of hinging on, let's see, the court ruled that the Trump administration failed to carry out an adequate environmental review, which of course they literally bypassed shortly after inauguration to fast track this through. So, you know, as the running theme of our show has been, and surely also the Trump administration, it's been kind of errors from one's own incompetence. Like, they just didn't do the due diligence, gave the green light, and they're being caught on that very lack of due diligence. So presumably, yeah, there'll be a few more briefings to decide whether or not the pipeline will be shut off, but it's definitely leaning that way, which is great. I haven't read how much it's actually pumping right now. I doubt that it's going full bore, but I'm not sure. I'll have to look into that this week and try to give some notes about
it. It's doing actual pumping at this point. I think it might just be preliminary.
It might, I mean, yeah, because the story mentions whether or not it should be shut off, so I wonder if that means...
Oh, no, I was wrong. It completed its preliminary pump, and it became commercially operational just a week and a half ago.
Oh, and there we are. Okay. So, yeah, I'll have to do some more research, see exactly what kind of capacity, how many gallons they're running through that thing, just for something else to touch base on next week. But hopefully, yeah, this continues to move in the right direction and they do indeed get shut off. I mean, that will, of course, only be until an environmental review, which under a Trump administration with the Army Corps of Engineers and, you know, the help of a severely hampered and mostly fired EPA. Like, I can't imagine anything other than a rubber stamp. But it slows everything down, and it gives the water protectors a bit of breathing room for them to prepare the next case and the next fight as to however else they're proceeding with this.
I was just thinking, you guys are right. It's like the Muslim ban, except it's for the environment.
Yeah, exactly. Like, this is just like this is the technicality that we can fight on right now that's going to keep it in the courts for another few weeks to another few months. Like, it's just one more thing until we look at the next small thing we can catch them on.
I'm constantly amazed at certain segments of the right, particularly the, if I can steal a line from Captain Planet, the Loot and Pillage faction on the right, with complete control of government, could get their way fairly easily if they had just stopped and taken 3 months to do it in some semblance of the right fashion. Some semblance of, you know, environmental review, which reaches the conclusion that we all know it will because they don't really care, but they still dot their I's and cross their T's, and nobody would be willing to step on that because of, you know, the executive branch deferment and all that. And yet they don't. They try and ram it through anyway, which gives the ability for their opponents to stop it. It's oddly self-destructive, and I've never... I guess this is why I'd be much more scared of a President Paul Ryan, for example, who actually know how to do the official things in a way that aren't going to be completely tossed out. He's going to eliminate Medicaid in a way that doesn't get a federal judge to stomp all over and be like, oh, you didn't do this right. I'm scared and yet also grateful that they don't know how to do things right.
I have to be crude. I see competing impulses here. On the one hand, you absolutely do have the loot and pillage faction, the make as much money as possible, as dirty as possible, and get it done. But you also have the rival impulse to do whatever you can to make the hippies as sad as possible, as quickly as possible. And don't even bother with doing it the right way, because hippies prefer that you do things the right way, so it makes them sad if you do it the wrong way, too. So I think that's probably what went out here, honestly.
Oh, man. I'm led to believe that hippie tears are very valuable in certain conservative markets.
Absolutely.
The Dakota Access Pipeline, is that... I'm not sure what it's doing right now in its very first phase of operation. The ultimate goal of that, if correct me if I'm wrong, is to bring Canadian tar sands to tar sands oil to market, correct?
Yep.
So, as odd as this might be, the tar sands are very hard to get oil out of. Extremely hard. It takes a lot of energy and a lot of money to squeeze a little bit of oil out of them.
Yeah.
I understood it was really only economically viable at very high oil prices. Oil prices approaching $100. There.
Correct.
So below that, the pipeline would actually lose money pumping tar sands.
Yeah, and to that effect, they've attempted to get other contracts, I think, to move additional, you know, different oil through there. Because, you know, Keystone XL also was supposed to be specifically tar sands oil. And in the original plan, you know, the original loot and pillage plan, both pipelines would have run full throat the whole time. And that would not have been all tar sands oil. So I know that there is some other oil that they wanted to move through those pipes. But I know tar sands is a big one that often comes up. And yeah, is already falling to the wayside to market prices and market pressure. Sadly, more than like reason.
An analysis
compassion
back in 2013, 2014 was that the nominal cost to get a barrel of crude oil out of the Alberta tar sands was something like $87. So you have to do better than that to start making profit.
That sounds about right, yeah. I know that they've worked on some efficiency technologies and whatnot to try to lower that, of course, to try to make whatever money they can or just to keep it making it viable. But yeah, I would not be surprised that that's still roughly the price per gallon point of what manufacture.
Yeah, it takes so much energy to heat and squeeze these rocks and extract what little oil there is out of them. You have to process greater than a ton of the sand before you get a single barrel of oil.
And then, it's super shit oil. Then they have to refine. They have to extra refine it. They've got to do all of this other stuff to clean it up. Kind of, yeah. There's nothing good about that at all. It seems like a completely indefensible product.
The one, I guess, not completely horrible use for it was the old settlers used to throw, you know, handfuls of stuff into their stove and use it to heat their cabins over the winter, and it was known even by them as being incredibly dirty, incredibly smoky, and this was a time period where people were used to the inside of their houses being caked with wax. 6 foot, so I mean that's telling us something there.
Yeah, it is kind of sad when we can look back to like the 1800s as a time of more reason. Because, you know, people said the same thing about coal then. Like, we act like it's a surprise in the 21st century that coal made the London skyline dark. You know, I mean, I guess to be fair, most of the world was very, very aware that this is a thing. But a good half of our country is unaware that that is a real thing, in fact. And, you know, then we'll talk about clean coal and, oh, coal's so great. Why do you have to hate on coal miners and whatnot? Like, they just pretend like it doesn't do anything. I'm like, no, no. People in the 1800s knew that coal sucked buttholes. Like, you can tell. You see it when you burn. It's there's a lot of thick smoke.
Of high-density chemical energy.
Exactly. Like, they used it because that was the best thing that they had, and it was cheap comparatively, and they didn't have to chop down trees all the time. It did make it great, but, you know, now we talk about it in the U.S., like, coal is black coal.
Even clean coal is such a misnomer. The coal's no different. They're just sticking a bunch of new technologies on the outflow stacks and sequestering that CO2, hopefully. Doesn't always work. But
they're not making
coal any better to burn. They're just trying to grab all the bad shit before it escapes. At some point, you're going to start running into a problem about what we do with all this sequestered carbon. Nature has ways of sequestering carbon, too. This is, you know, the permafrost is a great, great source of sequestered carbon. It's all melting and releasing all that. Like, that carbon will...
It's going to kill us all. It's paying its back.
Yeah, that's...
Oh, man. All right. Well, happy times. Happy times. That's been our Gatota Access Pipeline check-in. I assume we will return to this when the judge issues a final ruling. You want to keep an eye out for this, JJ?
Yeah, for sure. Oh, of course. Yeah, I mean, that'll pop up. I'm sure, but I'll see it.
Absolutely. Let's swing around and do our local check-in here. I've got one story coming out of Oregon. We have talked a few times over the last year about possible returns of Governor Kitzhaber. Dan, you were at a healthcare summit where he was at, showing his face for the first time in about a year. There's been some new developments which might point to a future for the old governor, Oregon's longest serving governor. I believe he had 4 or 5 terms there. The federal government has decided they will not file charges, not that he committed no crimes, but that they are declining to file charges against him and his wife. There are a number in there. She reportedly peddled influence, perhaps not explicitly, but implicitly because of her connections to the governor's office. The most salacious one that dug up during the investigation is that she married an 18-year-old Ethiopian man in 1997 for $5,000 in order to get him a green card. That one took up a lot of real estate newspapers when it came out. Probably the least consequential charge on there, but the one that most people gravitated towards.
I mean, yeah, what does that have to do with influence related to him being governor?
It's because there's a good white person marrying a brown person for, you know, less than pure reasons, JJ. It's just going to drive...
Scandal.
Yeah.
So it was more just like, this is background scandal to demonstrate what kind of terrible people these two are.
I swear to God,
okay.
This was the front page story for 3 straight days in Oregon.
Wow.
Jesus, is there nothing more important happening in Oregon?
She allegedly steered over $8 million in state contracts to her allies or people who had patronized her with gifts or whatnot, but no. The
yeah, now see, yeah. That's a front page headline. Okay,
it was more important stuff happening.
Like, oh, green card marriage when she was 18. Who gives a shit?
Yeah. Yeah, there was more important stuff happening in the scandal itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Even in this one, this is, you know, a year and a half on, they mentioned that within the first 4 paragraphs before they mentioned any other crime.
Yeah, that's really disappointing, I gotta say.
Yeah. Well, the Oregonian, you know.
The feds have declined to file charges. The couple made a very lengthy and emotional apology. It was penned by Sylvia Hayes. John Kitzhaber appeared before the cameras to give a brief statement that wasn't full of information. Ms. Hayes had a much longer statement that was posted on Facebook. It runs to probably 12, 14 paragraphs somewhere in there. It does kind of wipe the slate clean. I don't know if it's as clean as they would like. The state or the feds were very clear that they were not exonerating the couple, that they were simply declining to file charges. I don't know where the future holds for them, but there is no more impending indictment hanging over his head.
I don't know. Think he'll run for mayor?
Yeah. He's a new mayor.
Yeah. That's probably the most I could think of at this point. I mean, Brown seems to be doing a great job. Neither of Oregon's senators are really going anywhere. So that's about the only place I could think of him going.
Our mayor has not been turning out as well as we would hope. So perhaps I'll be looking at Mayor Kitzhaber in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's flip it up to Washington. I think Dan will start with your link. You have a little bit of inside baseball topic on here. It is probably most of interest to those in Northern Washington who are also claiming liberals, but that's, I imagine, a fair bit of our audience. So
yeah.
Let's dig into this. A little bit of background. I think you can talk in this with a fair bit of knowledge. You do work with employment contracts as a day job.
That's right. Collective bargaining agreements. So the story is just this week, the Sukuma brothers, berry producers, have reached a settlement with the union representing their employees, actually just this last week, for a new contract. And it's been a pretty lengthy process of getting there. There have actually been several strikes, boycotts over the last couple of years. Sukuma produces pretty much all the berries that you might find in a grocery store fresh anywhere around here, at least in the far northwest corner. And I would imagine fairly, further south as well. It's a fairly large producer.
I work in an old folks' home, and that is the berries that we get in.
Yeah. So if you wanted to be socially conscious, at least towards the rights of these particular issues, these particular workers, it's been really hard to get fresh berries. But there's been a boycott until last fall. The employer was refusing to even negotiate or acknowledge this union representing these workers. Like I said, since last fall, they finally agreed to sit down and negotiate. And just this last week, they've reached an agreement on a contract. The real issue, it seems, for most of these workers is they've been paid basically according to what they produce. It's a sliding scale on, the amount of poundage that they produce that covers how much they get paid per hour. The fast pickers, they do pretty well. They end up getting around 15, but the ones that may not go as quickly, they've been at minimum wage, stuck at that, which, up until this January was $9 and change and has just gone up to $11 an hour. So the new contract sets a wage floor for them of $12 per hour. Also very important, wages are a big part of these agreements, but the other is workplace dignity and workplace rights for employees. I have not seen the specifics of this contract, but at least the reporting is that it does include a, quote, conflict mediation process, resolution process. So that may involve requiring some cause for termination as opposed to the at-will nature of employment that agreements end up going to by default, or possibly a formal grievance process, which is certainly something that we strive to include for resolution of disciplinary issues or termination of employees in our contracts.
So it seems to me from reading this article that one of the biggest pushes that the workers had was the contract, at least the one that they had operated under before, allowed them to make, like you said, that amount, extra amount based on their poundage. And mm-hmm. they were complaining that in order to make $15 an hour, which was what the new average wage will be targeted as, workers would basically have to kill themselves, have to move at an unsustainable pace. They've now taken the scale that they pay above and beyond the contract wage, I guess, put it on a curve. They're normalizing it so that 15 will be the average, and then how you deviate above and below that will affect how much more you get.
That's right. It looks like they've mostly just bent the curve in a direction that results in higher wages. You know, starts at a higher floor, and assuming a more average level of output gets them to what should be an average level of wage, about $15 an hour.
All right. This is not a large number of employees, I guess. 66 workers voted on the contract.
Mm-hmm.
I'm impressed that 66 workers are able to constitute the workforce of one of the largest berry producing farms in the Northwest.
It would not surprise me if it's a larger workforce than this. I mean, this is just the number of people that voted on it. At least, you know, from what I've seen in other contract votes, you may get, you know, half of the workforce that actually participates in the vote itself. You know, that's really, really the important area for allowing representation by the union, of course, is in your certification of your bargaining unit. So it may be a much larger workforce than this. I would guess from a 66 workers participating in a vote, you may have upwards of 100, 150 that are regularly picking, but may not be participating in this vote, you know, whether for language barrier reasons or just, you know, they're busy out in the fields right now. This is prime farm working season.
All right. JJ. Swing over to your neck of the woods there. There's a bit mm-hmm. going on in Seattle. You want to start with the democracy vouchers, which is a great name.
Yeah, it's something I talked about, God, it was months ago. I can't remember when. Whenever we got them in the mail. Yeah, I talked about them very briefly. It was just a series of, I think it's the four vouchers, four $25 vouchers that you give to elections, either city council or mayoral elections within the city. And yeah, you guys, I had seen this as well, and I'm glad that you posted it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see, they've only cashed in just shy of a quarter mil in democracy vouchers, which. And they gave out quite a few. I mean,
looks like over half has gone to just one candidate.
Yeah, right? Which is also very interesting.
Yeah,
John Grant, I believe I voted for him this time.
I'm actually curious to see what the breakdown of other donations would be if they went as heavily to John Grant, or if this reflects a base of support that's perhaps not as able to spend money.
Yeah, I mean, if I recall him correctly, let me look him up so I don't accidentally speak about somebody who's not that guy. Yep, okay, totally that guy. Cool. Yeah, he's a former director of the Tenants Union. He's a major affordable housing advocate. And he's running for city council a second time. A lot of people really liked him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely going to appeal to a far left, people who are more likely to use the vouchers, for one. And then also, like you said, probably some folks that didn't have the money before or just don't usually donate to political campaigns.
It also might have something to do with, have you guys pulled up his website? The entire front page above the fold is a big form for pledging your democracy vouchers to him, where you stick in your name, your email, your phone number, and
check
a box, and they will, like, send out a volunteer to pick them up from your house for
you.
You don't have to.
Wow. Very smart.
He's making a very big play to collect his in, whereas the others might be ignoring that further.
Yeah.
That's a smart play on his part, then,
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense if that's how he's using it, because it looks like using these does require some limits on the amount you can spend, the amount of contributions you can pick up. So if you're going to go in on it, you might as well go all in and collect as much as you can to give yourself an edge, at least against the other candidates who may not be using it.
He's almost making this like an Uber experience. You don't have to
anything.
Just punch in your name, your address, your phone number, and somebody will show up and grab them for you.
Sure.
And I mean, if that means you get all four of somebody's vouchers, that's $100.
Yeah. When
for just like a volunteer to come and stop by your house for like that'll pay off for him.
You know, the last time I ran for office, I would get in a car and drive to pick up a donation smaller than that. So yeah. It's worth it.
Gotcha.
Absolutely. JJ, did you hand out your democracy vouchers?
I have not yet. That was the second reason I was happy that this story got brought up, because I was like, oh shit,
gotta do it.
I forgot about my democracy vouchers. I gotta like send those things out.
Yes, yes.
And also find them.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I don't have them, but.
Very nice. I would be interested in seeing a postmortem of this election, how these turned out, whether or not candidates and voters thought that they were a good idea or not.
And I'll be curious if more people utilize them, you know, to see whether or not we can say it's going to have any real effect.
So the fund, according to the news article I'm reading, it's expected to collect $3 million annually in order to distribute these. There's a new fee on home taxes. It's not actually a tax itself. It's a fee you pay when you pay your property taxes, and I guess it adds $11 on average to each house. Not too bad, I have to say.
No, nothing major, and I mean, make sure to tax, you know, homeowners, people with theoretically more money. It's a great idea. I, like apparently most of the rest of Seattle, forgot about them, so we all need to get our shit together and use our democracy vouchers.
It's not a disaster. I guess apparently unused vouchers, the city keeps money and just uses it in the next election cycle.
Yeah, very smart. Well, good.
Sure.
Good deal.
So, even if you don't find yours, JJ, you're just pre-funding future elections. That's what you...
I mean,
save it for next time.
That was smart of them for city council, you know, in a place where marijuana is legal. So, like, people might forget about these. We better bank this money just to hedge our bets against people's stupidity.
So the limits that you alluded to, Dan, they are, if you take the public financing, if you accept democracy vouchers, you're limited to spending $150,000 in the primary election and $300,000 total. So you could spend less money in the primary and spend more in the general. If you only want to spend $50,000 in the primary, you could spend $250,000 more in the general. But you can't spend more than $150,000 in the primary and more than $300,000 in the general.
Right. Which is somewhat similar to... you know, federal financing, at least of the presidential election. I don't have the figures off hand, but basically that's been something that major candidates no longer participate in, at least for that office.
Not since Obama.
Did Bush take federal financing? I don't think he did, but
I'm pretty sure pretty sure Obama's the first candidate to completely sign off.
Interesting.
Financing. Let me actually look that up since we have a second.
Sure.
Oh no, I guess 1996 was the first year that somebody signed off on it.
Like Steve Forbes? I mean, because I can't imagine Bob Dole would have gone without it. Huh.
In 2000, Bush accepted public funds, as did Al Gore. In 2004, Bush and Kerry both declined the public funds.
Interesting. Okay.
And in 2008, Obama became the first nominee of either party to not take public funds at all. Even in 2004, both Kerry and Bush took them for the primary, but not the general.
I think with Obama, the issue was whether or not he would take him for the general election, because that covers a much shorter time period. You know, for, I think in his case, it would have been 2 months and maybe a week. And so, yeah, a lot of candidates would issue taking public funds for the primary just because you're doing that for 18 months, 2 years in some cases.
Yeah, the primary is up until the nomination.
Exactly. Yeah. And so you didn't want to be kept under spending limits, you know, up to your convention in, say, August and get pounded with the ads that you can't really respond to because you've hit your spending limit.
So apparently, just from this little brief that I'm reading on this, because of the number of candidates that are declining public matching funds over the last few years, we've got a third of $1 billion that kind of kicking it.
Interesting. Yeah.
Over $300 million in public funds that are supposed to be earmarked for campaigns have just been sitting in a U.S. government account.
I don't think I'm going to contribute to that this next year. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Usually you want to be a good liberal and, you know, contribute to public financing.
On the public financing and your taxes.
Exactly. Yeah. But it sounds like there's plenty there right now and nobody's taking it. So who knows? Maybe Gary Johnson will win it next time or something. I don't know.
Maybe this is the answer to shoring up Social Security right here.
God.
Oh, God.
I'm not going to try and give them ideas. So I'll stop at that one.
Somewhere Paul Ryan's like, aha.
I know how to do it.
Oh, man.
We'll take one last look up at Seattle going on right now. And I guess our show's favorite Seattle Councilwoman Bay, Kashama Sawant, who is a full-blooded socialist, not a Bernie-crat, but I think you should.
She's the real deal.
Yeah, you showed an anecdote, Dan, where she was the actual nationalizes industries kind of socialist. She is very forceful in arguing her positions, which is a breath of fresh air in a world where liberal is considered a dirty word, even by many on the left. So why don't you tell us about her latest stand, JJ?
Yeah, this was a great article, too. This was an excellent post. Steve Ballmer, is he the guy who runs Microsoft, or is he just like a sports ball owner douchebag?
No, that's Paul Allen.
Paul Allen is I actually like Paul Allen. But Ballmer was the former second command of Microsoft after Bill Gates retired. He took over.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Former CEO. I feel like he owns a sports ball something or other.
Oh, he probably does.
They usually do, yeah.
Sure, he does. That's it, man.
He might have a piece of one.
Yeah. So anyway, apparently he complained. He wrote an op-ed in the paper bemoaning a proposed income tax in Seattle that will only affect people paying $275,000 and up,
mm-hmm.
and very slightly, I might add, also
2%,
I think 0.18%.
Well, so, that's what their total income. It's 2% of every dollar over 250 grand. Yeah.
Yeah, which they say means people pay like $500 or $5,000 for somebody that earns half a million a year. So Steve Ballmer decided to write an op-ed and cry about it, and Shauna Sawant came out, as she loves to do, as a PhD economist, and be like, well, the rich person is wrong and he's lying to you. And I can give you that effect, which is wonderful, because politicians don't usually get to sneak from that position. But yeah, she says, and I quote, there's absolutely no evidence in statistical studies of taxes on the wealthy of any kind having any negative kind of consequence. And then she relates this to the same stories that we heard about during the fight for a $15 minimum wage, which, has not been catastrophic, though stores have definitely squeezed on their workers in the city as well. So there is a squeeze. I can't say I agree with her entirely. There is a squeeze. But
the 2%
overwhelming benefit to workers. But this tax is a slam dunk. It's a small, small increase. It will not affect the vast majority of Seattle residents. It will bring in $125 million, possibly, which, you know, isn't as much as the weed tax brings in, but it's cool. That's still $125 million. This is a good tax.
It's a small number of people it impacts, but considering the amount of money that we're talking about for most of these people, it's not very much. If you're making $1 million, it's going to be less than 20 grand. And that's also deductible from your federal taxes. So,
And let's be honest, it's not like these people pay their taxes to completion anyway. So anytime a rich person is like, oh, you're making me pay taxes, like, they're all lying anyway. They're not even going to pay half.
They've got the money for the good accountants, you know, as Trump said, they're smart.
Exactly. They pay like 5% of the taxes to us.
I think probably my favorite thing about this story is that she has the ultimate boogeyman. It's Steve Ballmer in this.
Oh, yeah.
If you want some background here, he was the 30th employee of Microsoft. He was the very first manager that Bill Gates hired. He was given an initial salary of $50,000 and a percentage ownership of the company, 8% when Microsoft went public. In 2003, shortly after becoming CEO, he sold off half of his stock for $955 million, reducing him to 4% ownership, and immediately canceled the employee stock options program at Microsoft. Immediately, just completely shut it down so that no other employees could benefit. This was the start of a very strained relationship with Bill Gates. Bill Gates thought that was one of the worst business decisions of all time. He didn't think that Microsoft would be able to hold on to talented engineers without stock options. He started a fairly public feud with Steve Ballmer, which continues to this day. They do not talk with each other. And then he drove it into the ground by abandoning the PC. He stopped the PC-first strategy that Gates had used to build the company into a giant. You remember the Kin phone, Microsoft Kin? That was a product of his. Remember the Surface
RT? I do not.
Actually, Microsoft apps? Or x86 apps, that was him too. He spent over 13, maybe I'm getting that number wrong. He spent many billions of dollars on acquisitions that ended up not doing a single thing.
Let me guess, is he responsible for the Zune?
That was all his
tech. Of course.
Dude, I love the like first 7 Google images that come up when I Google him. He also looks like a soulless madman. He looks like a dinosaur trapped in a human body that's trying to get out.
Intense eyes, yeah.
He refocused the entire company on Windows Mobile, seeing the PC market die, and managed to lose both the PC market to Apple and Google with the Chromebooks, and lose the mobile market as well to Google with Android and Apple with iOS. He made a pivot from the one thing that Microsoft has always done very well to something it has never done before, and in the process lost both markets. And really just terrible CEO. Business Insider is a great story where he admits that he spent the last 3 weeks at the job watching over 100 days of the good, or 100 episodes of The Good Wife on Netflix while he was supposed to be working. And that's not like somebody in the office saying that. That's him giving a post-mortem on his time and being like, my last 3 weeks I just watched Netflix.
And continuing his sterling decisions, he does in fact own the LA Clippers.
That's what I was just about to say. He bought them from Donald Sterling. Yeah.
There's a great piece in the Register, which is a somewhat snarky UK tech news site that has a great review of why Ballmer was forced out of Microsoft. But Microsoft is a Seattle legend, and Bill Gates, you know, for all his faults, and I'm not saying he's a great guy, but he's always been somebody who seemed to care about the people who work for him and care about society in general. He's signed a pledge with Warren Buffett to give away more than 90% of his wealth. He is well on his way to doing that. He's transitioned to philanthropy. I think when you pick on Steve Ballmer, as Gashama Salant has done, you are doing nothing but good work in the eyes of Seattle residents. I have, at least that's my opinion.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to go on to what we're following this week. I'm going to use it to touch on something that we did not address in the show. I left it off for, I hope, issues that are full on their face. There was a major shooting that happened in Alexandria in Northern Virginia this week. The chief whip of the House, Steve Scalise, is in the hospital. He is improving. He took a bullet to the hip. He was in critical condition. He's now been upgraded to serious condition. Five others were shot. The gunman himself was killed. What we know at this time is that he was a domestic terrorist. He targeted political opponents, in this case the right, with deadly force. He had a list of Republicans he wanted to shoot. And that was news that broke this morning. Apparently, there's a list of 30 people long. I don't think anybody would disagree with me in saying that it's unacceptable to shoot and kill the people you disagree with. It's wrong when they do it. It's wrong when we do it. It's just wrong. The video of the incident is horrific. You can hear dozens and dozens of shots nonstop. Witnesses at the scene reported that he fired somewhere around 100 rounds. It is horrifying to watch if you can stomach it. I would suggest you check out the video. This happened on the day that the House majority, the House Republican majority, was debating, was set to debate a bill that would deregulate silencers on weapons. This is madness. This should show you that this sort of firepower does not it or trained at all in any way. It doesn't come from one side of the spectrum. I don't want to sit here and pretend that Republicans are the only ones who do things bad. It's for both sides that we have to put an end to ridiculous armament of the population that allows people to escalate differences, escalate disagreements from a heated argument or even fisticuffs into a deadly confrontation. I've used the example before. If George Zimmerman didn't have a gun, the issue with Trayvon Martin would have been a two-sentence blur police blotter about a street fight instead of a national conversation about race. These things kill. And this was our, sadly, daily reminder in America that this happens. I avoided talking about the show because as think JJ said it wonderfully in the Facebook group, that the show occasionally runs the wanders the full gamut of our outrage. Is that the phrase you used, JJ?
Yeah, I think that that's it, yes.
Yep.
This is something I have no outrage for. It is simply sad and unfortunately all too common in this country. So I'm going to be following more news out of this and what is going on, whether or not we're going to see a serious conversation about this. One of the tweets I shared talked about the fire in London that happened the same time, in fact, within hours of the shooting, about how nobody in England is arguing that we shouldn't use that as an excuse to talk about fire safety. Nothing should stop us from using this as an excuse to talk about gun safety in this country.
Hear, hear.
Amen.
All right, what are you guys following?
After you. Okay. Yeah, I've got some. So if you remember about a year ago, when we were talking about the Panama Papers, there's a Norwegian team that went through some of those and were comparing some of the data from the Panama Papers to internally released government documents and whatnot about income, and have found that the richest people in the country were about 30% richer than previously estimated. Norway is one of the least unequal countries. They have one of the best scores on the income inequality index. So the expectation then is that, you know, in countries like the UK or of course the US, that not only are our estimations of income, you know, wildly off, which everybody already knows anyway, this just gives us some numbers to kind of play with. But yeah, exactly. Yeah. We know that they're way richer than they tell us we are, or they are. But in Norway, it was 30% richer. So in the U.S., the Wild West of finance, like, God, that number is probably frighteningly larger than even I think it would be. I feel like it would be reasonable to say like 90, 100, maybe 120% more, and I'm probably still like undercutting it.
A lot of our financial regulations are designed to keep that sort of information explicitly secret. So yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, but so it's nice to see that people are in fact using some of these leaks. You know, of course, I mentioned the Malta Papers a couple of weeks ago, so I'm sure that people will start going through that information as well. And this is the long, wonderful investigatory process of hopefully exposing and trapping and prosecuting white-collar criminals. So there's my happy story.
Wow. Yeah.
About who's going to be first up against the wall when the revolution comes?
I mean, no. Like, who's going to go put handcuffs for being white-collar criminals? Because they suck dicks, and those people need to be prosecuted. We don't have to, like, go all let them eat cake on it or anything.
Just let the system work, you know?
Yeah, man. Just give the system a chance, Brock. I thought I was the crazy lefty.
I was quoting the Hitchhiker's Guide, okay? All right, Dan, what about you? What are you following?
All right. It's more the headline, top line story, but it's pretty crucial, and it's actually a bit of a twofer. So we've got the Georgia 6th special election, which is, after what seems like months and months, finally coming to a head on Tuesday. It's of all of the current vacancies, it looks like it's the best opportunity for a seat to flip from red to blue. And while we've seen some pretty solid movement in the right direction in pretty much all of them so far, this is one where it may actually result in a Democrat winning a Republican seat, one that's been in Republican hands for pretty much ever, Newt Gingrich's old seat. Where this gets important into the substance, at least for me, is that at the same time, we're still seeing a lot of stories coming out about how the Senate is making movement to finally proceed with passing the American Health Care Act and repeal the Affordable Care Act. So far, there have been a lot of elections that should be scary for Republicans, but they haven't had one that was an outright loss. So my hope is that if this is a seat that they end up losing, that it may act as some kind of shock, some thunderbolt that may convince them to back off from what's likely to be a pretty savage cut to the well-being of millions and millions of Americans, which will be difficult to undo. I mean, it can be done, but it takes time. So I'm watching Georgia 6th, and I'm watching what the Senate does with health care this week. They've said, I think they want to try and get it done before the end of June. So maybe they can
keep off that a little bit.
Yeah, I think they've mentioned possibly ringing it up later, but it gets logistically very difficult to do that.
I do want to point out that you made fun of me a little bit for putting my hopes in Murkowski. And
oh, yeah.
This week, she released a statement saying that she will not vote for a bill that takes any funding away from Planned Parenthood, though it does look, at least on the abortion issue, that she's standing pretty firmer than I would have hoped. And there was that wonderful
wow.
clip of her rolling her eyes at Trump.
That was fantastic. Yeah.
That's pretty great.
That was, I mean, also, I feel like that's a pretty easy one. Like, I mean, I know we all know how crazy Alaskan politics is, but it's still not Trump crazy.
And
like,
yeah,
even that.
And I would hope.
Dan, you're
Kathy
like, well, it's pretty crazy, you guys.
Murkowski is one of only two openly pro-choice Republican senators. She has to feel pressure to actually hold on to those beliefs. If she's just going along with the party that takes that choice away, there's no use in giving herself the label. If that label means that
I would absolutely.
Oh, well, yeah.
She has to stand for that.
And I'm overjoyed that she is. That's awesome.
Doesn't make up for the fact that she's a douchebag in plenty of other ways, but on at least.
Right.
No, not at all. But, like, hey, gold star on this one.
Yeah, I mean, she's 0-for-4 on making the pro-choice vote on Supreme Court nominations at this point. But
yeah,
or 0-for-5 actually now. So, yeah.
We'll see. All right, guys. Mm-hmm. Thanks for joining me. This has been the June 18th edition of Cascadian Views. I'll see you guys all next week. And JJ, I hope to see you at the beginning of August.
Yeah,
awesome.
All right. Have a good one, gentlemen.
All right. Have a good week.
Bye. Thank you.